Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. This is episode 66 of Text Messages, a conversation with Kristen Kishore. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. Every now and then, an author comes along whose books are deep and beautiful, and whose approach to writing and living helps readers gain perspective on their own lives. Kristen Kishore is one of those authors for me. Although I don't have a lot of experience reading fantasy, I fell in love with Graceling, Kristen's first novel, when it was published in 2008. Like a lot of other readers, I was drawn to main character Katza, in part because she's bold and fiercely independent. But what moved me is that Katza has a grace or special gift that feels like a curse. Horrible as it sounds, Katza has a talent for killing. As a result, she's been forced to work as a henchman for her uncle, the king. I felt compassion for the way Katza struggles with self-hatred, and I admired the way she compensates for that by organizing a secret council to right wrongs and correct abuses of power amidst a backdrop of shifting political alliances among seven kingdoms. Fire and Bitter Blue, which are companion novels to Graceling, offer readers a similar blend of political intrigue and identity work. What makes Kristen's fantasy novel so great is that the world-building always serves as context for philosophical questions and the inner growth of her main characters. That's probably one of the reasons why her books are so widely read. They're complex structurally and emotionally, which makes them compelling for all kinds of readers. Reading them makes me wish for more fantasy novels that offer a similar blend of magic and real-world relevance. As fantasy author Tamara Pierce put it, "Fantasy is the stories we tell ourselves to give shape to our dreams and desires, and the forces we suspect are working beyond where we can see right now. That's why we write it, and that's why people respond to it so passionately. Fantasy writers are speaking directly to people's souls." Kristen Kishore speaks to our souls through her novels, but also through her talk about writing. Although each of her books has made the New York Times bestseller list and won multiple literary awards, Kristen never pretends that the work of writing is easy. On her blog, she talks candidly about the process of pushing through uncertainty, despair, and exhaustion as a writer. I've derived tremendous encouragement from her honest and insightful posts. She shared a new one when I was right in the middle of work on this podcast. It helps so much to hear someone I respect and admire talk about the moments when writing feels agonizing, and it helped to hear about what she does to push through that feeling. I had the opportunity to interview Kristen Kishore last November at the National Council of Teachers of English annual convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. In honor of the recent release of Bitter Blue in paperback, in this episode, I'll bring you excerpts from our interview. You'll hear about Kristen's long and difficult process of writing Bitter Blue, how music helps her with her writing, her thoughts on reading the work of other writers, and more about the ways she copes when her own work gets hard. I began the interview by asking Kristen to talk about her struggle to write Bitter Blue. For readers who aren't familiar with the book, when the story begins, Bitter Blue is the ruling queen of a damaged kingdom called Mansi. Under the rule of King Lek, Bitter Blue's father, individuals and the society as a whole experienced great trauma. Now as queen, Bitter Blue realizes she has to help herself and her people face that trauma in order to heal.
When I sat down to write Bitter Blue, I had just finished writing Fire. Fire was very... her head was a very hard head to be stuck in for those 2 years while I was working on that book. It's a sad book, and so I came out of that book thinking, I have got to write a happy book. I sat down thinking, Bitter Blue is going to be my happy, funny book. But since I'm not going to make it as emotionally complex as Fire was, I'm going to make it as structurally complex as possible, just to keep myself interested. And of course, you know, obviously, like, this is what writers do over and over, I think. You have to have this denial about what you're getting into, otherwise you wouldn't begin. Of course Bitter Blue couldn't be a happy book. You can't write a happy book about a young woman whose father murdered her mother 8 years ago. That's not going to be a happy book. So what I've discovered is, actually, this is going to have to be the darkest book yet. And now I've gone and made it as structurally complex as possible on purpose, which is also an unnecessary thing to do. These books always become structurally complex, even if you intend them to be simple. So I realized, after I think just a few months of writing, what I had gotten myself into. But I was still really committed to the book. And the only, you know, I'm pretty sure it was Robert Frost who said, and I always quote him, the only way out is through. So I just kept going. It was very hard to keep my faith because I was making such slow progress. And the more I would write, the more I would feel like I was far away from the end. I kept thinking, oh, this will be the same length as the others. Then I realized, no, this one's going to be longer. Then I realized this one is going to be twice as long. You know, I was sending emails to my editor, kind of freaking out about the length. And Kathy would write back and say, you know, don't worry about it. And don't worry about how long it takes. And you seem like you're working too hard. Maybe you should take a break, you know, which was so helpful. To have her, she could be the person who's saying, write faster, why aren't, you know, we have a deadline, but instead she was giving me what she knew I needed, which has always been the case with Kathy. And so it was just a matter of pushing forward, even though I knew it wasn't working, which is disheartening, and just telling myself, I will fix this later. You have to tell yourself, I can do this, because even if you don't tell yourself that, you're not going to be able to do it. Even if you don't believe it, you have to say, I can do this, because that's just necessary for you to do it. I mean, maybe I couldn't. I always said it, I can do this, thinking, well, maybe I actually can't, but unless I tell myself I can, I definitely won't.
Kristen went on to explain that after the excruciating work of writing the first draft of Bitter Blue, her editor, Kathy Dawson, helped her to see that the book still needed more work. A lot more work. In fact, in a blog post from December 2012, 5 months before Bitter Blue was published, Kristen posted a picture of a bookshelf containing each of the different drafts of the novel. There are 5 in all, not counting the copy edit version and the typeset manuscript. They are really, really thick. They're wrapped in rubber bands. The last 2 are marked up with dozens of post-it tabs, and together they take up an entire shelf. I asked Kristen to describe what happened after she turned in that first draft to Kathy.
So it took 3 years to write the first draft. It was 800 pages long. It was a mess. I sent it to my editor. She read it. She sent back one of her typical, extremely long, detailed editorial letters, and partway through the letter she said what had turned out to be the most wonderful thing. She said, I know this is going to sound a little crazy, but here at the beginning of the revision process is the moment to put crazy ideas out there. Would you consider starting again from scratch? I freaked out a little bit. I mean, it took me 3 years to write that horrible draft, but then I, as with everything Kathy says, I trust her, and so I knew there had to be a reason she was saying this. I knew that she wasn't suggesting that the whole book was wrong. In fact, if you look at that first draft and you read the final book, it's the same story. It's just told in a different order, in a different way. She was right. I needed to tell the story again, tell the same story again. Now that I knew all the moving parts and knew all the necessary characters, I needed to sit down and think of it in a more streamlined, simplified version and tell it again. So I actually did start it again from scratch. It only took 4 or 5 months to write it the second time, and it was much shorter. I removed some unnecessary characters. I was working like there. I had this writing adrenaline during that time that I still can't believe. I was working 13 to 16 hours a day every day, not taking a day off. Just so desperate to do this and to prove to myself I really can do this. There is a book here. So I just kind of spit the second version out and gave it back to her. And she read it and she sent me her next extremely detailed letter to get started on the next revision. And she started the letter with, "You have done a miraculous job with this revision." And it was just so satisfying and such a relief. And of course, you know, she then followed that with all the things we needed to change. But it was, and I still can't believe the process. I can't believe how hard that book was to write. I really bit off a lot more than I could chew. And then just kind of had to figure out the way to chew it, I guess.
For people who are interested in writing and the writing process, like me, these behind-the-scenes stories are fascinating. What I find equally fascinating is that Kristen drafts her novels by hand. She fills up spiral-bound notebooks, and then she uses transcription software to dictate what she's written into a computer document. In that same blog post from December 2012, Kristen offers up photographs of actual pages from her notebook, pages that eventually became the novel Bitter Blue. On these pages, you can see all the messy work of writing, lines crossed out, big X's deleting entire sections, tiny handwriting in the margins next to furious scribbled out parts, and even notes of encouragement she wrote to herself. Notes that let us hear her repeating her mantras. "This is crap, but push through to the other side. The only way out is through." If you're as interested in this stuff as I am, you'll probably want to buy a paperback copy of Bitter Blue. On her blog just a couple weeks ago, Kristen announced that the very post I've been quoting from is included as extra back matter in the paperback edition. I asked Kristen to explain why writing by hand is the most comfortable approach for her.
I don't know. Why does a painter decide they want to use oils rather than watercolor? Well, I know why anyone would not choose not to use watercolors, because watercolors are so difficult. But it's just my writing comes out of my left hand. It just does, you know? And I need to be able to see. You can't see as much on a screen as you can see when you have a notebook and you can flip quickly through the pages. It's kind of the same as the difference between reading a paper book and reading something on your e-reader, where you're so limited in what you can see. You can't, I mean, it's so frustrating. It's that same freedom to just be able to flip around easily. And also, if you make edits on a computer, the instant you erase them, they're lost. Whereas I have every single version of everything. I have crossouts, and I can see where this came from. I can retrieve words that I had used before, then jettisoned. Now maybe I want them back. Well, they're right there, crossed out. I can see what they are. And it's just, I can spread the pages out. I don't know. It's just, it's, writing is, writing requires making messes, and I can make better messes with pen and paper.
One of the many things I love about Kristen's blog is all the different kinds of things she shares on it. Really, it's a work of art, and it's pretty much my favorite author blog of all time. On it, readers can find those thought-provoking and comforting posts about writing, but they can also find the most beautiful photographs of snowstorms and orchids, rooftops and shop windows, umbrellas and streetlights. We also get glimpses of her writing desk, her favorite books, and links to songs and musical performances. Those posts are what let me know that music is important to Kristen, because she sometimes writes directly about connections between specific songs and her current work. I asked Kristen to talk about the role music plays in her writing, how it helps her, when she listens to it, and what it adds to her work or her thinking.
Music is so important. I very rarely listen to music while I'm writing. I need silence and, in fact, often have earplugs in because it really helps me focus. The one time I will write with music in, well, there are actually two occasions where I write with music in. One is if I'm in a place where there is sound and I'm trying to block out people's conversations. It's impossible to write because people's conversations are interesting, so I just listen to them instead of writing. So I try to block out. So if I'm in a cafe or something, I might put some music in, and then it's nothing with words, it's just something kind of soothing. And then the other time is occasionally when I'm writing and I'm in one of those bursts of huge adrenaline. I almost have too much excitement and energy about what I'm writing, and I need to funnel some of it off somewhere else. So I'll be listening to crazy music while I'm writing just to kind of take some of that energy off in a different direction, take some of that focus off in a different direction so that I can have the correct focus for what I'm doing. But music, I mean, there's a Patty Griffin song I listened to over and over and over again while I was writing Bitter Blue because it just had the mood and the sadness I was trying to get to. It's Cold As It Gets. I've blogged about it. And then there was a fiddling tune that I listened to over and over again when I was writing Fire. You know, I would stop writing, take a break, lie on the floor for a minute, listen to this five times, then go back into it. What's the name of the woman who plays that tune? I've blogged about it. Cynthia McLeod. She's a Prince Edward Island fiddler. And I picked up a CD while I was in Prince Edward Island and found this one track which just felt to me like the dirge, the lament at the beginning of Fire. It can create a mood. And then just music in general. I mean, I love all different kinds of music, and it's harder and harder for me to read because I'm always writing. So it's harder and harder for me to find a book that really satisfies me and that I'm not tearing apart the same way I spend my day tearing apart my own book. But music, I can get a break and I can get rest. I can rest and be inspired and by listening to music.
Readers might be surprised to learn that although Kristen has been a huge reader throughout her life, now that she's a writer herself, she doesn't read much fantasy. She said that reading it interferes too much with her own work. But she does read plenty of other things, including books by other YA authors. I told her that I loved seeing a picture on her blog of a tabbed-up copy of E. Lockhart's The Disreputable History of Frankie Landau Banks. I asked Kristen to talk a bit about her reading of that book.
Some friends and I sat down and talked about Frankie Landau Banks for hours. It's just so, there's so much going on. There's so many different kinds of feminism happening in the book and anti-feminism happening in the book. And I feel like Frankie is, you know, it's her practice year as she prepares herself to rule the world. You know, this is her getting her, starting to grow her wings. I also just love Alpha. He is disgusting, but he's also just a very familiar character to me. And I love the power dynamics. I guess if I had to point to one thing that makes me love this book, I love power dynamics between people and watching them play out, watching how complicated they can be. That I have a lot of fun with that in my own books, writing them. And I just find the power dynamics among all of those characters, socially, class-wise, on many different axes, just to be fascinating and very exciting.
As you can tell, I've paid a lot of attention to Kristen Cashore over the years. I admire her curiosity and her intellect, and I admire her emotional honesty. At some point during the many hours I've spent scrolling through her blog, I came across a poem she posted by Rumi. It's called The Guest House. I love that poem, and I wanted to hear Kristen's thoughts on it. To end this show, I'm going to let Kristen introduce the poem, then read it to you, and then tell you what it means to her.
Oh my God, it's just... Every morning you wake up with... And everything rushes in, and sometimes it's just really difficult to feel like, okay, can I do this? Can I do this again? Can I cope? This poem to me says, don't fight it, just let it in. And that little shift in thinking that, no, this is wrong, I have to change this, the what's happening today or the way I feel, that little change in shifting it to, this is what is, that's fine, that's life. I find that to be so comforting. I feel like we're brought up in this culture encouraged to just push away pain. Pain is a sign that, something is wrong with us. And I think it's actually just a part of being human. And so there's a certain kind of self-acceptance for me with this poem. Just let myself be however I am today, sort of thing. The Guest House by Rumi. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door, laughing, and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. As I read it, too, it reminds me that this, I've blogged this as well. Writing is so much like life. Like, this is what writing is like as well. There are these doubts and these voices telling you, you can't do this. And I've gotten in the habit of, rather than fighting with them, just kind of letting them sit in the chair next to me and actually feeling really sad for them. I imagine myself, you know, this guy who is always telling me, you are wasting your time. You can't write. This book isn't going to work. I imagine myself sitting him next to me. He can say whatever he wants. He can, you know, make as much noise as he wants. He's welcome. I give him a hug now and then because he's so sad and pathetic. And then I just keep writing. Like, that's just what it feels like to be a writer. And that's just what it feels like to be human.
I hope you will read Kristen's books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Transcription help on this show was provided by Betty Gibson at St. Louis University. Next month, I'll be back to bring you stories of teens struggling with mental illness. Books on anxiety and depression can shed light on the pain and hurt that some teens feel. They can also show teens and the rest of us that healing is possible. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening and look forward to more text messages soon.